to go, we're free to stay. But most of us don't want to make the decision for ourselves, hoping that we're really not alcoholic, that we really don't need AA, that there's an easier, softer way. Well, there is the cemetery. It's real nice and soft. They water the grass every day. Yeah, the cemetery. You bet. Because, you see, obviously nobody but the newcomer himself or herself. We've got to take their word for it. In fact, you don't even have to say it aloud. And that's fortunate for many of us who arrived today with only half-hearted desire to stay sober. Yeah. Now, once again, I like to go back and dig into the history about this tradition. Now, the basis for this tradition, they used to have what they call a clubhouse in New York, old 23rd Street clubhouse on 24th Street. Now, that's typical of AA. And Barry was on the desk, and the door opened, and two policemen drugged this character in there. And they brought it up to the desk and said, "This needs to be here with you. It doesn't need to be in jail." Now, I'm going to describe it. I'm going to call this character It for a while, and I'm going to describe It. It had on a lady's dress, wearing a lady's hat, blonde hair, lady's earrings, lipstick in rouge, carrying a lady's purse, wearing lady's silk hose, tennis shoes, and it was black. Barry looked at It and said, "What do you want to do about stopping drinking alcohol?" It said, "More than anything else in the world, but man, let me tell you, I've not only been drinking gin, but I've been on the needle, I've been on the horse in those days, heroin, I've been on smack and snow in those days, cocaine, and I've been taking them California mollies and turnarounds and pink and blue buzzards." Barry said these magic words. Listen carefully. "What do you want to do about stopping drinking alcohol?" Well, it was a clubhouse, and over in the corner there were some clubhouse cripples playing dominoes. And they ain't worked in about 9 months. They get in there and they're hitting on the new gals, you know, and stealing the coffee and money and everything else and robbing the basket. And they took a look at it and said, "Get that out of here. It's going to ruin our reputation." Barry said, "It wants to stop drinking. We don't care what it wants." So two of them got up and grabbed It and took him to the door, opened the door, and threw him out and closed the door. Well, as I said before, every time they had a problem, Bill was alive, so Barry called Bill. "Bill, you better get down here at the clubhouse. We got a good one going." Bill said, "What's the deal?" He said, "Come on down here." So Bill hops a cab, and he comes down, he's walking through the door, and he sees It there, and he looks at Barry and said, "What's that?" And Barry said, "That's the problem." Bill said, "Well, what's the deal?" And so he explains how the police bring him here, and how the rednecks over there playing dominoes threw him out. Bill said, "Barry, did you ask it if it wanted to stop drinking alcohol?" He said, "Two times." But Bill, he also said he was on the needles and pills and all that other stuff, smoking that grass. Bill said, "We're not interested in that other stuff. We're only interested in one thing. What did he want to do about stopping drinking alcohol?" "Barry, I'm going to ask you again. Did you ask him?" "Two times." Bill said, "What did he say?" He said, "More than anything else in the world." Bill said, "That's all we need to hear, and that's all we need to know." And Bill goes and picks It up, takes him over to where they're playing dominoes. He said, "Boys, I want you to meet the newest member of AA. He needs you, and you need him, and that tells the whole story." Now, I'm going to talk about It for a while. One of the most tremendous members of Alcoholics Anonymous ever lived. If you read Problems Other Than Alcohol, where it talks about members who have made remarkable recovery from both the bottle and the needle, that's It. Now, the reason that It, now don't get any funny ideas about it because he had a dress on. It was a tremendous dancer. He could tap dance. He could do anything in this world, little light skip. And in order to buy booze and them other things, he got a job in a vaudeville kick line on Broadway and naturally had to wear women's clothes. But the problem was, during the intermission, he'd go out and wander around on the streets. And the last time he wandered around that rig he was in, and the police were worried about his life. So they brought him down to the deal. I heard him make, Harold is his name, I heard him make his last AA talk. Harold would make an A talk. He'd set a trap for you. There's no way you could ever get out of it. From the time he sat at that table, and that was 1945, and I heard him make his last AA talk in 1984. He never took a drink of alcohol from that time on. We all have to ask ourselves one question. Where would all the members of AA be that he sponsored and turned sponsored, who in turn sponsored and turned sponsored, said, no, you can't come in. You look and you smell different. Period. And that tells the whole story. Who are we to keep anybody out? To many a desperate drunk, AA is the court of our last appeal. Well, no, we can't slam the door on anybody who stands outside. No, we should not do that. We always have to take the risk, no matter who comes in. Maybe our public relations will be damaged because a few strange characters are among us. Of course, our public relations are very, very important. But it's not the real character of our society still more important. You know, in the first group, Group 1 in Akron, Dr. Bob was alive. And that's a long time ago. They got a human being came in whose sexual habits and attitudes were different from straights. And they didn't want him in the group. We can't have that in the group. And they went to Dr. Bob. Bob, we can't have this in the group. Can't have him. Dr. Bob looked at him. He says, boys, what would the master do? And that was never asked again of Dr. Bob. Yeah. You have to remember that the agent that forces us to come to Alcoholics Anonymous will either force us to stay or it will eliminate us. One of the two. And we don't have to get exercised about it. Because if there's anything, we are in the business of communications and communicating. And none of us like to be isolated and walled off. We were isolated and walled off before we got here. And if you ain't got nothing to say, you ain't got nothing to say, you know? Uh-huh. And just like they were said one time, fella, you never open your mouth, you never say anything. Why? He said, if I don't open my mouth, people don't know how stupid I am. That's exactly. Yeah. And so as a result, no, we must take the risk no matter who comes in. You know, no, who of us dare say, no, you can't come in, thereby setting himself or herself up as judge, jury, and perhaps executioner of our brother and sister alcoholic. So our experience through the years, now distilled in Tradition 3, says, you are an AA member if you say so. No matter what you have done, what you are doing, or what you ever will do, you are a member as long as you say so. And so now this brings us to 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups and AA as a whole. Now, a member who does any amount of traveling finds the AA spirit much the same everywhere. I can assure you that this weekend, if you've never been here to this particular conference, there's not a conference any place anywhere in the world exactly just like it. It has a certain feeling. It has a certain spirit. Those of us who travel in AA, and many in this audience do, and go to other conferences, other areas, they're very fine. But if you notice, there's vast differences among them. It's just like there's vast differences among groups. In a group, a traveler may find maybe 3 or 4 discussing the steps in somebody's living room, back seat of a car, or in a yard. In one part of the NRLs, they may listen to 300 or 400 talking in a crowded auditorium. In one part of the United States, respectful silence greets the one who said, hi, everybody, my name is David A., and I'm an alcoholic. In Southern California, until you announce that you are an alcoholic, no one will say hi back. That's been their principle for a long, long time. In many other places, they introduce themselves by full name. There are one-hour meetings. There are hour-and-a-half meetings. There's all-night meetings. There's candlelight-burning meetings. There's incense-burning meetings. There's barefoot-burning meetings. And everything in this God's world, in every town or city, in every part of the world reached by AA, the local group is free to work out its own custom. That's how AA grew all over the world. It wasn't forced on anybody. And I know, and you know, when I happened to be a delegate at the General Service Conference, Wednesday night was a free night. And it happened to be my AA birthday. And we all went out to dinner, and we went to this big meeting in AA. And, you know, and they got 2 or 3 10-minute talkers. And then they take up the collection while everybody's there. And then they have a break. The secretary announces everything. And then they have a 45-minute talker. Well, this fella gets up, and his name was Joe. I'll never forget it. And he said, "My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic." Well, there's a whole bunch of us. We call us from the Bible Belt. That's Texas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. And we're all in this meeting. And we hollered, "Hi, back." Well, they didn't do that up there. And they thought there's a whole bunch of drunks. You see, you have to remember about them folks up in the northeast part of the United States. They're not cold. It's just defects of character. That's all. Yeah. Yeah. In many other places, they introduce themselves by the full name, you know. Now, as always, freedom brings responsibility. Now, because each group is autonomous, it's up to each group to avoid any and all action that would harm AA. And there have been such actions, or this tradition would not be necessary. Now, for blown up into multiple signs, the big ego may inspire one group to take over, let's say, all the public information work for its area, without consulting any of the other local groups. And once that group has decided that it has all the answers, then the lid blows off. And then that's when it starts. I don't mind telling you. So in a way, the fourth tradition is like the fourth step. It suggests that an AA group should take honest inventory of itself, asking about each of its independently planned actions. Asking this one question, would this violate any tradition? Unfortunately, they ask it after the ox is in the ditch, you know? Like the individual member who chooses to make his or her and the 12 steps in her life his or her guide towards reasonable, happy, and contented sobriety. The wise group recognizes that our traditions are not hindering technicality. They are proven guides towards the chief objective of all AA groups. And what's the chief objective of all AA groups? Tradition 5. And as our individual and group development progress, we obey our traditions for other reasons. We obey them because we think that they are right for us. We obey these principles because we not only think they're good principles, even though sometimes we'll still resist. Then comes a final level of obedience. The best of all, we obey AA's 12 traditions and steps because we really want to for ourselves. It is no longer a question of good or bad. We conform because we really want to conform. And such is our process of growth in unity and in function, and such is the evidence of God's grace and love among us. Now, many people who look at us, even members of AA, wonder, how does AA function under such seeming anarchy? Other societies have to have law, force, sanction, and punishment administered by authorized people. Thank God, happily for us, we found we need no human authority, whatever. In AA, we've got two authorities. God as we understand him, and alcohol as we understand him. And one heals, and one kills. And we don't need any human people grabbing that power handle. And there's a God, our Father, who simply said, "Here is my will for you as a sober alcoholic to live the AA principle." I believe there is a prayer in the big book. May I do thy will always. Yeah. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Not how society or anybody else. Yeah. Not how even our sponsors want it. Yeah. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. And how does he do it? Through the recovery program, take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always, which is meant to me and means to me right this second, that I have to continue to go through this process on a daily basis so that I can be of maximum service to the God of my understanding and my fellow man. Period. And that's God's will for David. Now, if it gets more complicated than that, I'm going to have to go get me another deal. I was in a meeting not long ago, and they got to talking about God's will. And one fellow said, it's God's will I buy a Honda. Now, God's not interested in what kind of car I'm driving. You know what God's interested in? If I can't afford to pay for it and they repossess it, what's my attitude? That's exactly what God's will for me. And so as a result, I said one heals, one kills. He said, you better live God's will or I'll kill you. And sometimes alcohol does kill. And so when all the chips are down, we conform to God's will or we perish. That's the whole crux why AA works. Period. We got a killer and we got a healer. And neither one of them are human. Isn't that something? Yeah. So there's authority enough, there's love enough, there's punishment enough, all without any human being grabbing the handles of power. And such is AA's backstop against dissolution and its final guarantee of survival under any and all conditions. For us, it is to do or to die. Many, many years ago, they thought about incorporating Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. At one of the General Service Conferences, one of the delegates, he was from Mississippi, an outstanding, sober federal judge, a member of AA and a delegate. And he asked Bob to form him a committee. Well, Bob picked his committee, it's a darnest committee, a former blacksmith, a former bank robber, and a reformed gambler. There were sober members of AA that all happened to be delegates. Well, they asked him next day, well, what's your committee come up with? We haven't come up with anything. They asked him the third day. We're not ready yet. They asked him the fourth day. We're not ready yet. The fifth morning, he said, Bob, what has your committee come up with? Bob got to the microphone, and he had a beautiful voice. And he says, I have to ask every one of those here in this conference this morning one question. How can you incorporate God? And that's the last time and the only time it ever came before our General Service Conference. How can you incorporate God? Tradition 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Now, the first tradition, our common welfare. The second tradition tells us who's the boss, God. The third tradition knocks off all the requirements for membership except one, a desire to stop drinking alcohol. The fourth tradition allows a group to be an AA group or a BB group. You know what a BB group is? It ain't AA. Now, there is a very significant word in this particular tradition. It says, had but one primary purpose, to carry its message. It doesn't say AA's message, does it? It's. Well, what kind of it is our individual groups? Does it carry the message of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous? Or does it carry its message to all things and for everybody that comes in? Bill was very wise when he put its. Because the previous tradition allows every group to be autonomous. Allows a group to be able to be free to make the mistakes. Period. Many groups have found it out the hard way. Those groups are no longer groups. They don't meet anymore. Yeah. Because you see, every newcomer learns, and some of us the hard way, this business of staying sober must have top priority. Now, if we fail at that, we cannot succeed at anything else.
Why, it gets over.
What?
The fifth tradition reminds us that groups should remember their primary purpose. And very often, unthinking enthusiasm puts a group off the main track. One group, for example, offers expanded AA programs that included helping newcomers find jobs. I've been in a lot of AA groups and meetings. You go look at the bulletin board and you can't find the meeting schedule. They've got microwave oven raffle, cake raffle, bingo. This is one I like. Need roommate. Must be at least 3 days sober, you know. Because of, and as a result, Tradition 5 doesn't frown on an individual member of AA who tells another about a good job. But when the group turns itself to an employment agency, the newcomer may get confused about the group's primary purpose. AA's function is to help them maintain their sobriety after they stop drinking. And then AA is not interested whether we're working, whether we're not working. Individually, we're interested in it. AA could care less. All AA wants to know is what he wants to do about living sober. That's all AA wants to know. Now, using discretion, a member may lend a few dollars needed for a meal or room, or even invite a broke alcoholic to be a temporary guest in your home. You've never lived until you've invited a broke alcoholic to be a temporary guest in your home, and they stay a year. God almighty. And I had one of them, I run off somewhere, and I found him up in Canada, and he come through Dallas, and he didn't have a place to stay, and the boys were all in university, and he used the back bedroom and everything. And one night, there's a knock on my door. And open it up, and there's two men there. Now, a policeman is a policeman is a policeman. I don't care if he's got brush-cut hair, mustache, smoking a pipe with white cotton lisle socks and suede shoes, or whether he's got long hair, wearing them snake boots. They're all alike. A policeman's born with a special physical impediment. Their arm is that, and it comes out like that. And there's their picture and their badge and their number and everything else. And one of them had a long piece of paper. They identified themselves, police. We have a search warrant for your house, home. And we're looking for somebody. I said, well, the one you're looking, they gave me the name. I said, the one you're looking for, he left about 2 weeks ago. But in the bedroom in which he was staying, in the closet, he left two big boxes and they're sealed. And you can come in and look at them. So they went in and they opened the boxes. My God, there's transistor radios in there, and there's rings and jewelry and everything, and some expensive, some very inexpensive. They looked at me and said, you know anything about this? I said, no, I never saw it before. Are you sure you're not one of his accomplices? I said, I'm sure. Well, we're going to have to take you and these boxes down to the police station. So they load up the detective's car, and I'm in the back seat with one of them, and I'm laughing all the way down to the jail. Because I'll tell you why, it's a thrill to go to jail when you're sober. Now, I'll tell you. And they take me before the night desk sergeant, and they explain about trying to execute the search warrant. They searched his house, couldn't find the individual. And we're going to take these boxes with all this stuff, take it down to the police property room. We're going to have it inventoried, and then we're going to see if we can get it back to maybe their rightful owners. But in the meanwhile, we're going to leave him with you. And they left me with the night desk sergeant. The night desk sergeant looked at me, took off his glasses, he shook his head, and he said, sponsor, when are you going to learn? And that's when I was laughing all the way down to the jailhouse. And I'd already told him about this character. He said, get out of here. You know? Yeah, but you have to remember that every AA group is not a friendly finance company, welfare agency, housing bureau, jail getting in, jail getting out, divorce counseling, anything else in this world. Now, even when acting on our own as individual members, an AA layman certainly should not award himself an honorary medical degree and hand out diagnoses and prescriptions and amateur analysis of other people's sicknesses. Now, because this personal failing is so common, The A group, in all of its dealings, should be extra careful to emphasize that it is not invading the medical field. Only through the personal experiences of its members is it qualified to carry only one message: how an alcoholic can recover in AA. That's all, period. And I'm going to share a very sad experience. There was a beautiful gal. In time she was 11 years of age, she hit the streets. And she started drinking and doing all them other things, needles, dope, everything. And she got into so much trouble. And she's in and out of juvenile correctional facilities. By the time she was 18, 19 years of age, her parents totally disowned her. They would not have a thing to do with her. And she's about 23, 24 years of age, and how she got her money, that was her business. And she was in one of these sports cars with a fiberglass body, the kind that'll do 180 miles an hour standing still. And she's out in the country, and she's drunk and on everything in this world that she could rub, suck, stick, doesn't make a better difference. And she was totally out of it, and she missed a curve and hit a huge oak tree. And not having a seat belt, and of course that fiberglass body just exploded like popcorn. And she came right through the windshield, and the top of her skull hit the trunk of that tree and crushed it just like jelly. It didn't kill her. But for many, many weeks, many hours, and quite a few months, she laid in intensive care with extensive brain damage and extensive brain surgery. They called her parents. "We have no daughter." And hung up. Well, she, through some miracle, she didn't die. She went on life support. And they couldn't keep her there. They had to do something with her. So they went before the county commissioner's court. And they had her committed for the rest of her life in the lock ward of as a totally insane human being in the insane asylum about 30 miles from Dallas for the rest of her life. They moved her there. Well, in AA, you know, a lot of times we get a lot of mileage and we laugh, ridicule psychiatrists, members of the medical profession. "Well, they put us on this and that and this and that. I got news for you. I don't know about you. If I wanted anything, I didn't need to go to no doctor." Mm-mm. I certainly didn't. Mm-mm. No. Uh-uh. But it's good to blame somebody. We get a lot of mileage out of you. You know, my grandpa was an alcoholic. My mama was an alcoholic. My daddy was an alcoholic. My uncle was. So therefore, I had to be an alcoholic. I don't know about you, but the United States government spent $2.5 billion researching why an alcoholic becomes an alcoholic. And after spending $2.5 billion, they found the total answer. And the answer was this: that an alcoholic becomes an alcoholic because he drank alcohol. But that's too simple, isn't it? Isn't it nice to blame somebody? Huh? Well, I'll tell you. If you're blaming your uncle and you're blaming your mama and that bloodline happens to be there, I don't know if it is or it isn't, you're the most wonderful and should be the most grateful person in the world because you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. And all the things that family, my mother and father wanted in my life have all come true as a result of the members of AA and the recovery program of alcohol forcing me, because I've kind of become the kind of son my mother and father wanted me to be. I've become the kind of husband, father, professional man, everything in this world, only because of God's grace through the miracle of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but more important, the living love of the members of AA who put no conditions on me, period, when I got here. They allowed me the freedom to stay or to leave. And I liked what you had,
and you attracted me to stay one day at a time. I really came here to see whether you're lying or not. And up to now, I haven't caught you. So I come every day to see if I can catch you. That's all. And hey, we don't get good. We get less bad one day at a time. That's all. And so as a result, you know, and so we ridicule him. Well, it just so happened in that particular section of the insane asylum, there was a refugee Cuban psychiatrist who knew a lot about AA. Now, knowing about and knowing AA are two different things. As he began to dig up her past medical records, he began to suspicion that she may be an alcoholic. And if this so, the only chance she ever had to get better was not in the insane lock ward with the totally insane people. She needed to be over at a place where she can get the kind of medicine that only our kind need and only our kind can benefit from it. And that was over at the Alcoholic Recovery Unit over in that institution. And that medicine is love. The greatest source of energy that a human being can exhibit as long as there are no conditions attached to it, for free and for fun. So he went over and talked to the head of the unit over there, and they agreed that when medically and psychotically he felt she could be moved, they go back towards the commissioner's court and have her transferred. And they did. And the commissioner's court had her moved. And there she was, totally paralyzed on one side, couldn't even remember anything, just laid there, the livid dead. But as the sober lady members of Alcoholics Anonymous would come in on a weekly basis and bring meetings, they became attached to her. And they talked to her, and they'd say, "Doll, everything's going to be all right, one day at a time." And she couldn't remember how to put on makeup or even wash her hair. They'd wash her hair and put makeup on, and they brought her some designer jeans. And they began to love her. And just like a beautiful, precious, dainty flower, she began to flicker and grow. And about 3 months, the unit was startled. There she was dragging that paralyzed side down the aisle and walking into the AA meeting. And about 6 weeks later, they were really excited. She giggled. And then about another 3 weeks later, she held her hand up and gave her first name. "I'm an alcoholic." And she got well enough to where she could have a weekend out, provided two sober lady members of Alcoholics not with her at all times. And they took her out and they brought her into Dallas. And they took her to meetings everywhere. And when they took her back on Sunday, the last thing she said, "If I ever get out of here, can I be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous?" See, she found a family that loved her just because for her. And no other reason. But we know the reason. It's our sobriety that benefits, whether she does or doesn't. That's the only reason we're here. Not to satisfy anybody else. Our own sobriety. Well, she got well enough to where she could leave, provided she had two sober lady members of Alcoholics Anonymous as her sponsor at all times, and a third one for a backup, and a place to live. They brought her out. They found a little efficiency apartment for her. She got a little part-time job, part-time self-supporting her own contributions. And she happened to be a member of the group that I'm a member. And God, she was absolutely a joy and a pleasure. No one had to tell her to get Scott paper and clean up on the floor where some of the members are too doggone lazy to do it, spilling coffee. And no one had to tell her to wash and clean the ashtrays. And no one had to tell her to pick up all the empty styrofoam cups. And no one had to tell her to make coffee or anything else. And she'd bring wax, and she'd wax the tables, and God, she'd wash the chairs, and it was absolutely, she just fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And then the great night came when she was one of them closed discussion meetings to where everybody in there is an expert about everything and don't know nothing about nothing.
And the topic for discussion at that meeting was that night, are you really sober if you're taking medication? And it got around to her. And she started sharing because of her massive brain damage and injury that she was subject to convulsions and seizures for the rest of her life. And in order to avoid that, at that time, it changed some of them now, she was on Dilantin with a small dosage of phenobarbital. And the minute she said phenobarbital, three members of the group took every inch of hide off of that gal. One of them sober 5 years, one of them sober not quite 2 years, and one not quite 1 year sober. And they screamed at her and said, you're not sober, you're taking dope. Not knowing any different. Never been to a tradition meeting. No different. In our group, we have sobriety cards. And they're filed alphabetically. Not by the first letter of our last name, but the first letter of our first name. And it's got our phone number down there if we care to be called on 12-step call. The name of our sponsor if we care to put it down, if the sponsor agrees. Period. And she went into the secretary and asked for her sobriety card. She tore it up and made a new sobriety card. That day as her new sobriety date. And then she went home. And she flushed down the commode all of her prescribed medication, which she was not abusing. The prescribed medication is to keep her alive so she could live sober. Not abusing. 3.5 weeks later, she had a seizure and a convulsion. Sorry. The kind that salt water won't stop. Honey and milk won't stop. Gatorade and honey won't stop. And she died. One of her sponsors called me. Said, I called her parents. Asked what they wanted to do with her. And they said, that's the greatest news they could ever hear about her. No longer would anyone ever have to make a phone call for her about her. You can do with her whatever you want to. And hung up. Then she said to me, well, what are we going to do about funeral services and a burial plot? I said, honey, don't worry about it. Not even for a half a second. We take care of our own kind. Period. We take care of our own kind. She'll have a beautiful service and a beautiful place to sleep for the rest of her existence. Period. Then she asked me, well, who are we going to get for pallbearers? And I said, I know three. And coming back from the cemetery, the graveside services, the one that was 5 years sober said, where did we go wrong? And I just simply quoted word for word from the fifth tradition from our illustrated pamphlet. That the AA group in all of its dealings should be extra careful to emphasize that it is not invading the medical field. Well, who makes up AA group? Members. Only through the personal experiences of its members is it qualified to carry only one message, how an alcoholic can recover in AA. Now, neither one of those three members of AA, the one was sober 5 years, one not quite two and not quite one, ever had seizures, ever had convulsions, but they heard. If you were here when I opened this morning, when I said in AA, we're asked to share our experiences, not our opinions, because we find the result of our experiences in AA that opinions in many, many instances have a tendency to make sick people sicker, in some instances to physically kill people. That is exactly what I was talking about. It was their opinion. They had no experience, period, period. Now, that's not an isolated case. It's happening all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world.
Once again in the group that I'm a member. Huge group. This happened to be a 12 o'clock noon meeting. And they had some very, very sick people in there. And one of those meetings to where the chairperson didn't have a topic and said, well, what does somebody want to talk about? Uh-oh. And they got on to something weird. And there were three of them there that were emotionally and mentally sick, groping for some solution to get some peace and comfort and serenity whilst not drinking. And they got off into some wild thing about feelings and emotions and everything else. After that meeting was over with at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, from 5 o'clock till 10 o'clock that night, three of them blew their brains out and committed suicide. Yeah. Yeah. You see, in AA, we have a lot of doctors, that's true. But thank God we don't have a one physician. That's it. Yeah. But long ago, AA felt it equipped to set up an alcoholism information center. Let me tell you, we've got thousands and thousands of members of Alcoholics Anonymous today that have been free of alcohol for many, many years, sometimes as many as 45, 48 years, that never would have been out in the free world. They would have been locked up in insane asylums the rest of their life because of the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And through good medical experience, combined with AA's experience, are productive, sponsoring sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous that otherwise would have been locked up in chains the rest of their life. Period. Period. Not long ago, one group felt itself qualified, you know, to be an information center, and the temptation was, you know, understandable. And it was even stronger at the time this tradition was written, because public ignorance about alcoholism as an illness was more widespread than it is now. Since then, other agencies have sprung up to assume the job of educating the general public on alcoholism. Education and educating the public on alcoholism is not AA's purpose. AA's purpose is to inform the public of who we are, what we are, but more important, what we are not. But these agencies are also trying to help the active alcoholic. They are our friends, and Tradition 6 establishes the boundaries of this relationship. Well, why don't we just go ahead and break now, and then come back at 1:30, and then we'll finish everything. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for your attendance. Thank you very, very much.
I can
sleep whenever I want to. Yeah. Hi, everybody. My name is David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And we're going ahead and numerically go on with our traditions. And we finished the first five traditions. And we have to remember now that, if we can, that tradition 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 maintain the fifth tradition. In other words, our primary purpose. And so numerically, we'll start with tradition 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Now, the related facility may be an outside group combating alcoholism or an enterprise that AAs individually and collectively want to start other than a group. And it was the latter, the enterprise that AA wanted to start, that most often confronted AA when it was a young and new fellowship. And you know what? Even today, it still confronts our fellowship, especially with all the trust money, tax-free money that's available today. Government money has run out. Thank God. Because our government today is cutting back on a lot of the funding that it used to do for things other than AA. And as a result of it, what goes around comes back around. AA is all over the world, you know, started when the huge Javits bill came in about 20 years ago. And a bill that was passed to start funding halfway houses and rehabilitation places for alcoholics and other problems, other addictions. And in those days, and the money was an alluring thing for a lot of members of AA. And so a lot of members of AA, they started going into the drunk business. And many of them thought because they had sponsored a few in AA or made a few 12-step calls, that qualified them to be alcoholism counselors. And as things began to get into a mess, because a lot of them, and that's heady business, and a lot of them went out, and if you walk down the street and say, if you run into a member you think is still a member of your group and say, it's good to see you, haven't seen it at the group meeting in quite a while, and one of them remarked to me, well, David, I'm a 7. And I says, what's the 7? Well, that's the government pay scale. I said, well, what are you doing? Well, David, all my life, that's all I've ever wanted to be is an alcoholism counselor. I said, well, you're sober, 5 years? Yeah. It took you 19 years to admit you're an alcoholic, and all your life, that's all you've ever wanted to be is an alcoholism counselor. And so later on, in the alcoholism field, they had to start their own certification program because for lots of reasons, and they're using other people's money and not AA's money, thank God. And so as a result, in the early days, outside agencies were very, very scarce, and some members of AA thought AA should cover the whole alcoholism field because they were enthusiastic. They're trying to get groups to grow. But AA, it's a slow process, believe it or not. It's a slow process. And led by some super motors, one group built an all-purpose center, including a section for a drying-out treatment. And they got into lawsuits and in the newspapers. And as a result of it, the drunks in the group begin to get diverted from their primary purpose of one alcoholic talking to another. And a lot of those ambition centers failed. But some individual members of AA have since founded some very successful clubhouses, rest farms, halfway houses. We got more 3/8-inch houses, 1/4-inch houses, 1/2-inch houses you can shake stick at today, where they taper a drunk out, just like they taper them off of a drunk, you know. These enterprises are run some by members of AA and patronized by other members and prospective members, but money and property are involved. And so, therefore, it has been proven wise by some very, very bitter experience to keep the operation of a facility completely separate from that of any AA group and to keep AA names like 12-step house, first step house, fourth step house, third step house out of the name. Now, towards outside agencies dealing with alcoholism, the AA policy is cooperation but not affiliation. Now, a group cooperates, for example, by welcoming referrals from treatment modalities, hospitals, correctional facilities, courts, anywhere they can come from, or by sponsoring AA group type meetings and institutions. But in one area, money for a rehabilitation was solicited at AA meeting, implying affiliation, and it certainly was. In another area of our country, AA was listed among beneficiaries of a United Fund drive. Now, AA members who are employed by outside agencies wear what we call two hats. But Tradition 6 cautions any such member against wearing both hats at once. It's impossible for an alcoholic to wear two hats at the same time.
It's very simple. We haven't got one head. Now, on the job, he or she may be an alcoholism counselor, but there's no such thing as an AA counselor. There's no such thing as an AA housewife, AA bum, AA banker, AA doctor, AA lawyer, AA bricklayer, AA carpenter. We haven't got but one kind of AA, and that's a member. We're a society of equals in AA. What we do on the outside, that's another matter altogether. But within the confines of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're all recovering. And no one has recovered. Yes, from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. But it was real to us when we were out there. And so as a result, at meetings, those who work in the field of alcoholism, they're just a member of AA, and they should be considered only as a member of AA. And those who work in the field of alcoholism should be considered themselves only a member of AA within the confines of their group or within the confines of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if it hadn't been for a way to live sober, they wouldn't even have a job, much less working any place in this God's world. And therefore, and they're not an alcoholism expert. Now, today we understand and accept the paradox. The more AA sticks to its primary purpose, the greater will be its helpful influence everywhere. Now, we're all perfectionists, and after failing at perfection, we had gone to the other extreme, and we settled for the bottle and the blackout. Then Providence, through AA, has brought us within reach of our highest expectation. So it became good reason, with this kind of thinking, why shouldn't we share our life with everyone? Well, we do share our life with everyone. It culminates in the 12th step. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics, and by practicing these principles in all our affairs, not just from 8 to 9 or 8 to 9:30 in a meeting, then we do share our way of life with everyone. Now, in the old days, they tried AA hospitals, and they all folded because you cannot put an AA group into business. You got too many busybodies. They mess up the formula. If you've got an AA group and you've got 60 members in that group, you've got 60 dictators. And no alcoholic wants to be a second-class dictator, because we work hard at being dictators. The AA group then many of them had to try at education. And when they began to publicly drumbeat the merits of this or that brand, people became very, very confused. They started asking questions. Did AA fix drunks, or was it an educational project? Was AA spiritual, or was it religious? Was it medical, or was it witchcraft? Was it a reform movement? So in utter confusion and discontent and disgust, AA found itself getting married to all kinds of enterprises in the early days, some good and some not so good. Then some AA groups started hounding legislators for legal reforms in this business of committing drunks to prisons and asylums. It made good newspaper reading in those days, but little else. And we might as well face the fact that the judicial system today in the United States and in Canada, they are very, very, very uncomfortable and becoming very disgusted with the same ones showing up before the same judge 2 and 3 and 4 times a year. And they come and because it's not the group's responsibility, nor is it to sign the court papers, individual members of AA can, but it's not the group's responsibility, nor is it Alcoholics Anonymous' responsibility. Because we have a principle in AA that we do not go and blab who comes to AA and who's members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Individuals can, but it's not the group's responsibility. Now, here is the fragility of it. They'll come in and they'll bring their court-committed papers, and they get them signed. And in many instances, and they've got gosh knows how many suits now pending and trials now pending, and they go out and they go back to drinking. And within a few 5 or 6 hours or maybe a day or two, they're picked up for either driving while intoxicated or drunk and disorderly, and here they're back up before that same judge. And the judge says, didn't you go to AA? Yes, Your Honor, but AA doesn't work for me. And they pull out this paper, and here it is. Now, here comes the fragility.
And usually they revoke their parole or they revoke their probation as a result of it. But here is their fragility. The judge takes the paper, he gives it to the bailiff, and he says, now I want this copied and I want it certified and put in the court records. All right, what have you got? You got the name of the group, the time it meets, if they have a phone number, the discussion, who chaired it, and the signature of an AA member. The judge gets this back and he says, bailiff, I want you to contact that group and I want a subpoena for in court to see if this particular defendant has been going to AA. And here you've got members of AA that are being served with papers to come to either that, and most of them may not, it may just come to the meeting and or this or that, you know, and it's signed in haste and this and that. And now it becomes a part of the court record, which is a public record, period. Instead of the judicial system being informed that just because they are committing them and sentencing them to AA does not mean that they're going to get sober and stay sober. We can't guarantee that to anyone. None of us in Alcoholics Anonymous can absolutely guarantee with 100% that we'll be sober next week, next month, next year, 5 years, 10 years, time. No. No. If we believe what's in our book, that we're not cured of alcoholism, that all we have is a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And so, in enthusiasm, a lot of correctional facility committee members are running out here and trying to build up the membership of the group rather than looking at the base of the group, and that is, are they staying sober? Are they staying sober? Period. And as a result, it made good newspaper reading when they committed to prison asylum, but little else. Then AA got mired into politics. So the experience then implanted a deep-rooted conviction that in no circumstances could we endorse any related enterprise, no matter how good, because we of AA should not and could not be all things to all people. It doesn't mean that we're going to try it, but we should not try. Then there was an AA member who thought about taking a public relations job with one of the large distilling companies to educate the public about why alcoholics should not consume alcohol. Now, everybody knows why an alcoholic should not consume alcohol except the alcoholic. But that liquor distilling company wanted the member to use his full name in all of its advertising, and he was to be described not only as a member of AA, but as its director of publicity. Now, there couldn't be the slightest objection if such a distillery hired an AA member solely because of his public relations ability and his knowledge about alcoholism. But that's not the whole story. For in this case, not only was an AA member to break his anonymity at the public level, he was to link the Alcoholics Anonymous name to this particular educational project and this particular distillery in the minds of millions. Now, I'll show you what kind of head this alcoholic has. I'm watching television. And here comes this well-groomed gentleman, hair all blowed back, got on suspenders, you know, and got on one of them ties that looked like somebody threw up all over it. Got on one of them new double-breasted suits, and he's got a grin from ear to ear. And he said, my name is so-and-so, and gives a full name. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am the director of publicity for this distilling company. And my head says, hey, wait a minute here. The best-selling brand of alcohol of that distillery is Old Buzzard. Now, if I drink Old Buzzard, I'm not going to be an alcoholic because Alcoholics Anonymous recommends this distillery. And therefore, if it recommends this distillery, it recommends every brand of alcohol that they make. Now, I guess I'm the only one in this room that thinks that way. Because I'll tell you right now, in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, most of us of something wants to ride on AA's coattails because AA had to go through some very, very bitter experiences. Members got drunk. members committed suicide, in and out with a lot of problems, and to come to find out that as long as we stick to our primary purpose, period, then we're always on safe ground. We're never skating on thin ice. And so he went to the group, and he told them, and they said, you're going to get paid for it? Oh, yeah. How much are you going to get paid? Almost $200,000. And they looked at him and said, hey, idiot, before you come to AA, 10 years before you come to AA, you were totally unemployable. You were sober 3 years. You never could get a job. What, are you sober 6 years now, huh, through AA, and you're going to make $200,000 a year? What's the matter with you? AA's been real, real good to you, hasn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he realized, as a result of the members talking to him, lovingly but very bluntly, that Alcoholics Anonymous literally saved his life. And therefore, its principles had to come first and not his own selfish principles. And he certainly did not want to be the guy to land AA in big-time trouble, and this he would certainly do. So concerning endorsements, our friend had said it all. We was it never before that we could not lend the AA name to any cause other than our own. Now, we now know as a result of our experience that the more AA minds its own business, the greater would be the general influence would become medicine, religion, psychiatry, social service, government agencies began to borrow some of our ideas, but above all, the results of our experiences. So has research, rehabilitation, and education. All sorts of therapeutic groups began to spring up. Today, they've got over 250 self-help groups that use what we call the AA method. Yeah. And they deal with gambling, divorce, delinquency, dope addiction, mental illness, weight reduction, parents with partners, parents without partners, parents who want partners anonymous, and everything in this God's world, you know, and anything you want to. I tell you, one of the funniest things is I happen to have a wonderful pleasure of being one of your trusted servants as a trustee on the General Service Board. And all the trustees are members of the corporations, that is AAWS and also the Grapevine. And the AAWS has its monthly meetings on Thursday. And we'd go in on board weekends and we'd go listen to them. And we're sitting back up there. And every month they get requests from therapeutic self-help programs wanting to use and borrow our material out of our big book. And this particular one was Nymphomaniacs Anonymous. And they wanted to their own adaptation of how it works, you know, from a portion of Chapter 5. And it really was, and when Madeline read it, it was really, really absolutely horrible, you know. And so, naturally, they rejected. But as another trustee and I, we're sitting over the corner, and we're just laughing and laughing and laughing. And Jackie is now passed on. And Jackie was chairman of the AAWS board. And she asked one, and said, Buck, what are you laughing about? And he wouldn't answer. And she looked at me and said, David, what are y'all laughing about? Well, we've been listening to y'all argue about whether you should grant permission reprint rights to Nymphomaniacs Anonymous. And she said, well, what are you laughing about? Serious business. Well, Buck and I were talking about, we want to know, if you will, can we get their number? We want to get on their 12-step list. And so as a result, all of them borrowed from our experiences, but as a result of AA not granting them reprint permission, thank God it forces them to make their own adaptation. For a long time, Narcotics Anonymous wanted to reprint our material. And the AAWS board says no. And that's the greatest thing in the world they could have done. It forced Narcotics Anonymous to put out their own recovery book. And it is a good one. And they wanted our 12 steps, but no. So they took their first step is we're powerless over our addictions and our lives have become unmanageable. That was the key point for Narcotics Anonymous. You see, it was nothing more than enabling. And they were what they were doing, they were getting away from the primary purpose of what they were supposed to be, and inferring that if they come in and use the AA 12 step for alcoholics, that it will heal and cure everything, you know? Are you addicted to worms in your navel? Come on in, you know? You know? Are you addicted to not taking a bath? Come on in. Let you be flush with this spiritual enema, and everything's going to be all right. Well, we know it's not going to be all right. In AA, we know this. Sometimes it gets worse before it gets better. Yeah. And so it forced them to do that. It's just like alcohol forced Alcoholics Anonymous to get down to the basic deal and not taking that first drink one day at a time and maintaining a simple spiritual way of life that works. That works. And so as a result, they borrowed from us. They worked their own fields. We don't have to endorse them or tell them how to live. And our influence has not only been confined just to these fields. It is now beginning to be very, very general. It crops out in political and business life. People who know alcoholics and their families are deeply affected. The very developments that AA once wanted to force have begun to take place by themselves, because in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, the old Alcoholic Association, which became the Alcoholic Foundation, which are the trustees, they could bring anybody they wanted to into AA. They could throw you out of AA. They could do this, they could do that, but no longer. In 1943, that was thrown out with a new set of bylaws and a new set of a charter. Now, one recurring problem faced by AAs who try to carry the message into treatment facilities is the proliferation of non-alcoholic drug addicts in these facilities. Now, often the guidelines for attending of these patients at AA meetings are unclear, which leads to complications on the part of AA members who try to carry the message into treatment facilities. Now, AA policy regarding non-alcoholic drug addicts is usually unknown to treatment facilities, and it baffles me every time I say that, because in treatment facilities today, it should be known, because we've got a lot of members of AA who are working in treatment facilities. And committee members and those who try to carry the message within these facilities find themselves in the position of having to educate professionals in this matter. Now, some treatment facilities are inclined to view all substance abusers and alcoholics as having the same common addiction and are treated accordingly. Now, you know, they'll say, well, a drug is a drug is a drug. Valium is the choice of that one, and alcohol is the drug choice of yours, David. And I said, now, wait a minute. I don't know about you, but I've never gone to the liquor store and told that man to sell me a half a gallon of chemicals or a half a gallon of drugs. He'd throw me out the door. Yeah. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous is non-professional in nature. We don't care what you drank, if it had alcohol in it, if it's paint thinner, rubbing alcohol, bonded whiskey, wine, it's what happens to you, not when you drink, but in between drunks. Now run that around your head a little bit. The inability to take it but not leave it alone. The ability to drink it and set her down and walk away from it on her own before we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. And the trouble starts, you see, when you're drinking, you're drunk. If we didn't have a maintenance program after we put that first drink down and don't drink anymore, I did that hundreds of times before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I always went back to drinking. Because I did not have a way to live sober. I didn't realize the nature of the illness that I had. As I said before, a mental obsession so powerful that it was condemning me to drink against my own will, and the physical nature of the illness was condemning me to die if I continued to drink. And so, as a result, now, as I said before, are inclined to view all substance abuse and alcoholics as having the same common addiction and are treated accordingly. Now, treatment facilities may have sufficient and valid reasons for employing these approaches during the treatment process. However, AAs who try to carry the message into treatment facilities
often find that non-alcoholic addicts are encouraged by the facilities to attend AA meetings within the facilities in addition because of the effectiveness of the AA recovery program and fellowship in providing post-treatment support for alcoholics. Non-alcoholic drug addicts are often referred to AA when they leave treatment facilities. In such cases, the practices of a treatment facility are clearly at odds with our traditions. We have to remember that our traditions are our traditions. They're not treatment facilities' traditions. They're not government traditions. They're not society's traditions, but they're Alcoholics Anonymous traditions. Now, AA's singleness of purpose must be communicated to the administrators and the staff of treatment facilities by qualified members of AA or members of the treatment facilities committee. Now, again, that type of member of AA has the task of informing and educating these professionals about AA's policy and traditions. Now, AA meetings within a treatment facility cannot be called substance abuse meetings. They are held for alcoholics only, including duly addicted alcoholics. Although enlightening treatment facilities personnel on the reasons for abiding by AA policy on this matter is often very, very difficult and time-consuming, experience has shown us that the most effective communication by AAs is done in a loving manner and in a spirit of cooperation. And those are not my words. Those are words verbatim from our treatment facilities workbook on page 83. And that has a composite of AA's experience worldwide. Tradition 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. There's not a tradition that's taken a bigger beating than our seventh tradition, because it has to do with money. And we have to be practical. A group can hardly hold its regular meeting on a street corner, and an empty basket will not fill a coffee pot. And as soon as we become active in an AA group, we learn how many other expenses are involved in making meetings effective. Then our horizons broaden. What about that intergroup or central office so many of us call to ask for help? Phone companies do not give free service. They're so thankful that we're sober and we're not trying to dig up the Ayatollah or to call some penguin bootlegger in the South Pole. I have a tremendous relationship with the phone company. They've led me to unbelievably understand that as long as I pay my phone bill, the service will remain on. And when I don't pay it, they'll cut it off. And that's what you call an understanding. Beyond our own localities, we learn about the AA General Service Office and the work it does for groups every place, everywhere. AA activity ought to be self-supporting at all levels, and in every case, the responsibility comes right back down to us as individual and collective members because we are AA. The members of Alcoholics Anonymous belong to us. God has given it to us as a gift. And he's given us the tools and the principles not to mess the gift up. Period. Sometimes, when we're new, our contributions rattle rather than rustle. And the first member's in the same fix. Now, very, very seldom in an AA meeting do you see them passing around an empty 2-pound coffee can. They pass around these baskets or a hat. You pass around one of them empty coffee cans, and you put a dollar in there, and it just goes down silently. And you put a quarter in there, and it goes plunk. When I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we could tell when they put a half a dollar in there. It had a certain ring to it. Uh-oh, somebody got a job today. They put a half a buck in that doggone thing. You know, and talking about that, I used to sit next to, he was reputed to be not only one of the wealthiest members sober in AA, but one of the wealthiest individuals in the southwest part of the United States. Oh, he's a tremendous amount of money. And I used to sit next to him, and the reason I really got to sit next to him, I figured I could fleece him out of some of his money one of these days, you know. And I'd sit next to him, and they'd pass the basket, and I'd put my little dollar in there, and he'd reach in his pocket, and he'd pull out an old-fashioned peddler's purse. It was folded over, and it always had 6 rubber bands around it. And he'd meticulously take the 6 rubber bands off, and it was about this long, and it had 3 snaps.
and the middle snap was the master snap. And he'd undo that, and that unlocked the snap on the right. And he'd run his hand in there and he'd manipulate it like a puppet, and he'd pull out a quarter, and he'd put a quarter in there. And I'd see him put that quarter in there, and I put my dollar in there, and here's a man that's worth, God almighty, several hundred million dollars, and I'm busted, and I'm putting a dollar in there, and I get resentful. It never occurred to me to go sit somewhere else, so I could never see him put that dang quarter in there.